Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're paying attention to the headlines, you've heard about ransomware, a computer virus that locks your files until you pay a ransom. But did you know that more and more businesses are under attack? The key to stopping ransomware is protecting yourself before you're attacked. With Carbonite, if your business becomes infected, you can recover clean files from their super secure servers. Best of all, you don't have to remember to upload files. Carbonite does it automatically. Try it free at carbonite.com/podcasts and receive 2 free months if you buy.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm James Reynolds, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 16th of January, these are our main stories. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives has signed the Articles of Impeachment against President Trump. They'll now be sent to the Senate, where he will be put on trial. China and the United States have signed a partial deal aimed at easing their trade war, which has dampened global economic growth. Also in this podcast,
clam shells were found in a coastal cave in central Italy. Under the microscope, the shells appeared shiny and unmarked, indicating that Neanderthal divers must have plucked live clams from the seabed.
New research has found that Neanderthals were able to dive into the sea to gather shells long before modern humans brought the skill to Europe. First to Washington, D.C., where the House of Representatives has taken its final step towards impeaching President Donald Trump.
All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. The journal stands approved.
The articles of impeachment were signed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Before the signing, she had this to say.
As you know, on December 18th, the House of Representatives upheld its constitutional duty and voted articles of impeachment against the President of the United States, Donald Trump. He said in the course of the debate that he did not uphold his oath of office to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution of the United States. The President takes a special oath, a little different from the congressional oath. In fact, he takes an oath that was taken by President George Washington, the patriarch of our country, in front of whose picture we stand here. So sad, so tragic for our country that the actions taken by the president to undermine our national security, to violate his oath of office, and to jeopardize the security of our elections, the integrity of our elections, has taken us to this place.
The articles were then sent to the Senate, where a trial will be held to determine whether or not the president has abused his power or obstructed justice. The case centers on claims that Mr. Trump pressured Ukraine into opening an investigation for his own political gain, which he denies. The House of Representatives has also picked 7 Democratic lawmakers to prosecute the case against Mr. Trump, and they're led by the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff.
President Trump put his own personal interests above the national interests, above our national security, and if not stopped, he will do it again. For that reason, he was impeached, and for that reason, the House managers will take the case to the Senate and to the American people. Because the appropriate remedy, indeed the only remedy, is the conviction and removal from office of President Donald Trump.
Congressman Adam Schiff. I spoke to our U.S. correspondent, Peter Bowes, and asked him if witnesses would be called once the trial got going.
That's another big question, and it has been a bone of contention between the Democrats and the Republicans over the last few weeks. It's why there was that quite long delay over Christmas and the New Year when the Democrats delayed sending or the final vote on the sending of the articles of impeachment because they were trying to put pressure on the Senate Republicans to agree to have witnesses. And it's still an open question. It seems at the moment what will happen is there'll be the opening statements of the trial. Senators will get to sit, and they have to sit and listen in silence. If they want to ask questions, they have to submit written questions. It's quite an arcane kind of procedure. And then at some point, we expect that there will probably be a vote in the Senate to decide whether there will be witnesses. And of course, that could open the door to witnesses from both sides.
Does everything else in American politics just stop during this upcoming trial? I'm thinking about those U.S. senators, Sanders, Warren, Klobuchar, who are facing upcoming primaries. They have to get out of the race and get back into the Senate.
Well, it's an unprecedented situation, and you pretty much summed it up correctly. It is a huge problem for those senators who are vying for the Democratic nomination to stand against Donald Trump in a few months' time, because they have to be in the Senate during the entire trial, when, of course, they'd rather be pressing the flesh and on the streets of the various places where there'll be caucuses and primaries over the next few weeks. They'd rather be out there campaigning, but they'll have to be in the Senate to eventually act as judge and jury over the president.
Peter Bowes. Now, just 2 kilometres from Capitol Hill is a famous address, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, of course, the White House. There, President Trump and China's Vice Premier Liu He on Wednesday signed the first part of a trade deal between the two countries. Mr. Trump described the agreement as historic.
Today we take a momentous step, one that has never been taken before with China, toward a future of fair and reciprocal trade as we sign phase one of the historic trade deal. Together we are righting the wrongs of the past and delivering a future of economic justice and security for American workers, farmers, and families.
Even before he became president, Donald Trump wanted to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China. As president, he has imposed billions of dollars of tariffs on Chinese goods. He's accused Beijing of unfair practice. China responded by imposing its own tariffs on some U.S. goods. Yet, the deficit still stands at around $320 billion. I spoke to our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, and asked her what exactly had been agreed.
Broadly speaking, there is a commitment by the Chinese to buy more American goods and services, specifically to buy a huge number of goods from American farmers. They were one of the groups deeply affected by this trade dispute that began nearly 2 years ago. There was also agreements on how to deal with the theft of intellectual property, something that has been a thorn in the sides of American companies for a while, how to deal with forced technology transfers, and a mechanism by which to resolve disputes. But there are questions about how realistic that enforcement mechanism is, because past administrations and other governments have seen promises and commitments made by China before, and it hasn't lived up to them. The other thing, James, is that this deal leaves out many other contentious issues that still remain.
Michelle, given all the rhetoric and the tariff wars of the last year or so, is this as much a general ceasefire between the US and China as it is a trade deal?
Absolutely. I mean, look, when this phase one deal was first announced, U.S. financial markets, businesses celebrated the news. But, you know, you talk to them today and many of them will say this is absolutely a truce, not the end of trade tensions. This is two countries fighting for economic dominance and a sense that there can only be one winner. And I think that is why you're seeing this change in approach and in relations between these two. Now, you can't take this out of the context of politics. This is also an election year in America. And of course, one of the things Donald Trump will be talking a lot about as he looks towards the November election is the strength of the US economy. He will say he has been good for American workers and for American businesses. And I think that speaks to this pomp and ceremony we've seen today. He was keen to take a victory lap and sort of enjoy the moment. And that was reflected in how long he spoke to reporters gathered in the room for the signing.
Michelle Fleury in Washington. Well, let's look a bit more at that deal. Phase one, as it's been called, commits China to making purchases amounting to $200 billion in U.S. goods, including farm products and other pledges on currency and intellectual property. That's in exchange for a small rollback in some tariffs or taxes. So how has the so-called trade war between Washington and Beijing affected U.S. companies? This report by Samira Hussein.
Relief can't come soon enough for workers at this sawmill in Hopwood, Pennsylvania. When China slapped tariffs on U.S. wood, retaliation against American tariffs on Chinese goods, business at this sawmill alone dropped 40%.
The questions every day is, so what's really going to happen? What's next? Are we going to make it?
As plant manager at this sawmill, Mark Tringhees sees the direct impact of the trade war.
We've downsized our sawmill. We've reduced our workforce in probably the neighborhood of 10 to 15 people.
That's a lot of people for a small operation.
That's a lot of people for this community.
What has been the biggest struggle for you?
The biggest struggle is keeping the morale up of the employees. We're here. We're here for the long run. But we need to get our exporting back. 66 employees here. This is their lives. This is our lives. We come to work every day to make a great product. And if we can't sell our product, we won't be able to make our product.
Northwest Hardwoods, which operates this mill, is not alone. The entire American timber industry is suffering. Northwest Hardwoods CEO Nathan Jepson.
Over the course of the last 18 months, we've seen exports to China drop by half. We've seen significant erosion in price as a result of having just too much lumber and not enough demand. And ultimately, the industry has seen revenues drop by as much as 30%, resulting in the need to cut back on production, cut shifts, close facilities, and lay off thousands of workers across the industry.
Wow, what a crowd. Look at that. Thank you.
It wasn't meant to be like this. U.S. President Donald Trump's pitch to the working men and women of states like Pennsylvania was that if he imposed tariffs on imports from China, their jobs would be protected.
So I just announced it will increase tariffs on China. And we won't back down until China stops cheating our workers and stealing our jobs. And that's what's going to happen. Otherwise, we don't have to do business with them. We don't have to do business. We can make the product right here if we have to, like we used to.
Despite 2 years of tit-for-tat tariffs, the U.S. economy keeps growing. The unemployment rate is at record lows, and financial markets have been hitting all-time highs. But the trade war has damaged many industries, particularly in manufacturing and agriculture, where so many of Mr. Trump's supporters worked. Finally, President Trump and President Xi have agreed to at least a truce, which should be good news for Northwest Hardwoods and thousands of other companies. But workers and executives across America may be left wondering if the end of the trade war was worth the pain of fighting it in the first place.
That report by Samira Hussein in the United States. Police have raided homes and offices in Germany and Belgium as part of an investigation into three people suspected of spying for China. More from Jenny Hill in Berlin.
Prosecutors suspect that two of the people under investigation had actively spied for Chinese state security and that a third was ready to join them. According to the news site Der Spiegel, one man was a German EU diplomat until 2017, when he joined a well-known lobbying firm and, it's alleged, recruited the other two suspects. The investigation comes at a time of intense debate over whether to allow the Chinese telecommunication giant Huawei to develop Europe's 5G network. Critics fear its equipment could be used for state-sponsored espionage.
Jenny Hill in Germany. Harry and Meghan, who are more officially known as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, have been under intense scrutiny since announcing last week that they would step back as full-time royals. Now Meghan is facing the prospect of hearing her estranged father, Thomas Markle, testifying against her in the High Court case she has brought against a newspaper for publishing a letter she wrote to him. The Duchess is suing the Mail on Sunday for breach of privacy and copyright and for misusing her data. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
There's a reason that members of the royal family rarely resort to the courts in their struggles with the press, and the Mail on Sunday's defence submitted to the High Court is a prime example. The paper pushes back at the Duchess of Sussex's allegations of breach of copyright, data regulations and her right to privacy. But it goes further. It says that the immaculate presentation of the letter and its one-sided content suggests that disclosure was anticipated. It says that contrary to accounts given by those reported to be Meghan's close friends, her father Thomas did contact her in the days before her wedding and did warn her that he wouldn't be able to come to the wedding because of health problems. He said he got a response that he believed was written by Prince Harry and that asked him to stop talking to the press. He said he tried to call Meghan but couldn't get through. How much of this is relevant to the issues of privacy, copyright and data protection is unclear, but it's a sign of how personal any court case might become. Mark Stevens, a media lawyer, says that Meghan is likely to win her case, but at the cost of poor publicity.
If you had to pit Meghan against a top-line QC who would forensically dissect what they've been doing, she's going to pay an enormous price. The lumps that will be taken out of her in the courtroom, the question is that worth it? Is that worth the win?
In Bradford, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, William and Kate were out and about talking with youngsters and visiting a community project. After a terrible 7 days, the work of the royal family goes on. There's still a lot of popular support for the royals. Officials will hope that the daily drama surrounding Harry and Meghan subsides soon.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. Still to come in the podcast.
The Saudi media said the suspected smugglers had travelled on foot across rough terrain on the border with Yemen.
We hear about how rare and valuable cheetahs are concealed as they are moved from one country to another. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has outlined constitutional changes that could see him retain influence beyond the end of his presidency in 2024. In his annual State of the Nation address, Mr. Putin said the power of Parliament should be boosted. Then, in another unexpected development, the entire government resigned to clear the way. The outgoing Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, justified the move.
In this context, it's clear that we, as the government of the Russian Federation, must give the president of our country the opportunity to take all the necessary decisions. And in these conditions, I consider that it would be right and in accordance with the Constitution for the government in its current makeup to resign.
For more on the background to President Putin's announcement, Pascal Harter spoke to Mark Galliotti, a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
This is, I think, where we've really got to the first time got to see the shape of the kind of Russia that he might well want to see after 2024, with three key elements. One is, at the moment, the system is incredibly presidential. As president, Putin has almost unlimited power. What he's going to do is weaken the position of the presidency so that he can, in a way, hand that to a successor without having to worry so much. Second, he's going to put more power in the hands of the prime minister, but also in the hands of a new state council, with many people thinking that Putin's lining that to be his landing pad. And the third thing he needs to do is to find a successor.
You've said that this is pretty shoddy treatment of Medvedev. Why?
I wrote that slightly tongue-in-cheek. Medvedev, his prime minister, has basically been the guy who just simply keeps all the boring stuff done. It's clear that Putin himself wants to involve himself in the exciting foreign affairs. Medvedev has essentially been the scapegoat. Anything that goes wrong, it's not Putin's fault, it's Medvedev's. And Medvedev has been a good soldier. I mean, he's done very well out of it. Now there's this offer that to transition him from being prime minister to deputy chair of the Security Council. It's definitely a step down.
So you don't see him becoming the chosen successor?
The only circumstance in which Medvedev is likely to become successor is if they absolutely can't agree on anyone else.
Now, you said that you think that President Putin is positioning himself to be the chair of the State Council. What would that look like? Would that look like an Iranian-style supreme leader?
This is the thing. We don't know. At the moment, there is a state council, but it's a purely advisory body. The idea is that sort of members of the great and the good of the Russian elite can give the president the benefit of their wisdom, and he can listen or not listen as he chooses. Now, that's clearly not the kind of role that Putin wants for himself. So it's probably going to be totally reshaped. What it's likely to be is exactly some kind of super body, the head of which would be some kind of father of the nation type figure. It could a little bit be also the way that in China, Xi Jinping has essentially sort of assumed this role as father of the nation.
Now, some people would say you're being very cynical and can't we just take this on face value? And this is Putin trying to get Russia to be more democratic. Do you think there is a possible interpretation that's a bit more generous?
I suppose I am indeed, like most Russia watchers, a deep and ingrained cynic. Not really. Look, I mean, I think it's clear that this is a system which will be in some ways more democratic. And in fact, I mean, I think it is from the outside world to be welcomed, these proposals. I don't think that's the reason why Putin is pushing them forward. I think it's precisely that it's only as he starts to consider a future not as Russia's president that he now starts to think about weakening the presidency.
Now, one of the things that really stood out for me, our correspondent in Russia was told, we live badly, but at least the world takes notice of Putin. Now, that living badly, Vladimir Putin did try to address that when he spoke, didn't he, when he addressed the nation, talking, for example, about supporting Russian people's dreams to have a family, to be able to afford to have children. Are those just words, or do you expect to see him take more notice of the economy now?
I think we can expect him to take more notice of the economy, but not so much for altruistic reasons as precisely because the Russian population, frankly, is getting a bit fed up. Most Russians care about quality of their lives. They care about the fact that the economy is stagnating, and they see the massive levels of corruption and embezzlement. So I think this is a political necessity.
Mark Galeotti from the Royal United Services Institute in London. Scientists say the past decade was the warmest on record. The figures have been compiled by NASA, the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the Met Office in Britain. Around the world, 2019 was one of the warmest years ever, 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. As our environment correspondent Matt McGraw explains, the evidence shows that the warming is having an increasingly disruptive impact on our weather.
One's got to see the broadness of the figures here, because these are millions of data recordings compiled by three separate independent agencies, all coming to the same conclusion. And in the last 5 years, how we've seen all across the world in various different places, how the impacts of this warming are being felt by ordinary people and everybody around the world. This year in Europe, we saw two separate heat waves. We've had fires in Australia like never seen before. We had British scientists yesterday saying the fires in Australia are a signal of what could be the world in a 3-degree world. So we're seeing very strong, consistent evidence from the data and in the real life. As the scientists say, people are seeing it with their own eyes when they see heat waves, when they see fires.
People are feeling the impact of global warming in two particular ways, in their health and in the food they can produce. I heard more from Elizabeth Robinson, Professor of Environmental Economics at Reading University in southern England.
What we're seeing already is more extreme weather conditions, heat waves. And so if we look at Europe, we know that elderly people, people with pre-existing conditions are particularly at risk of heat stroke, pressure on their kidneys. If we look, for example, at countries in Africa, where in mountainous regions, there's already a high burden of disease there, but now households are going to have to worry about malaria because of warmer temperatures. The mosquitoes are not dying off in these milder winters. We could think about the Baltic states, where every decade since the 1980s, we've seen an increasing proportion of the coastline where now it's possible that cholera can be found. We're looking at more than 80% of the coastline and more than 50% of the northeastern states of the United States, where cholera is now viable.
You mentioned a range of diseases there. Do governments in these particular countries have the resources to deal with all this?
It depends which countries we're talking about. So on the one hand, as countries are growing richer and reducing poverty, it's easier for them to deal with these. But no, you know, public health services, when you see them in practice in African countries, they're already stretched to the limit. And so, yes, it's going to be yet another burden on public health services. But equally in the UK, we're seeing increased pressure on our health services when there's a heat wave, more people needing to go to hospital.
How do the findings affect food?
What we do know already is that crop yield potential is falling. That means that over time, growing crops in the same way, you're going to get a smaller yield. Now, that hasn't really affected us so far globally because we still produce more food than we need to consume.
So there is enough food in the world?
There is at the moment. But what we know is locally it's affecting countries. So we can have two examples. One is domestically, if you relied on domestic production a lot, what we're seeing is yields are starting to fall in some countries. Extreme weather can wipe out harvest.
Such as which countries?
So we could look at Tanzania, we could look at Ghana, you know, Zimbabwe. These are countries that are all going to be put under pressure. If we look at countries that are reliant on importing food, we've already seen what happens when you get a shock in Australia. So in 2008, Australia suffered some sequential shocks. The wheat harvest went down. But the countries that suffered, it was not Australia that suffered from food insecurity, but small island states. And those are particularly dependent on imports.
The science in these findings is pretty stark. It's pretty unambiguous. Is the message getting across?
The message has got across, and I think we see that in the number of countries and regions that are starting to talk about commitments to net zero by 2050. It's easy to know what we have to do. Making it happen is politically very difficult.
Professor Elizabeth Robinson from Reading University. What's being described as a once-in-a-generation clinical trial to find new treatments for motor neurone disease has been announced by researchers in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. The trial aims to identify new drugs for the devastating condition for which there is currently no cure, but it will also look at repurposing other drugs. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes looks at how the condition affects people in the UK.
Motor neurone disease is a muscle-wasting illness that will claim the lives of around half the 1,500 people diagnosed every year within 24 months. It's been a particularly difficult illness to study and understand, in part because so many of those who have it die so quickly, but also because the mechanism which destroys brain cells that control movement, speech and breathing is poorly understood. This new research program aims to recruit hundreds of patients. One of those who hopes to take part is Alan Gray, diagnosed 3 years ago at the age of 54. He's outlived his initial prognosis, but is now unable to walk.
You can end up with paralysis across your whole body, struggle with swallowing, breathing. I normally wouldn't be eligible for drug trials because I've survived longer than 2 years, which is a typical criteria. So this is certainly a big step forward.
The trial will look at several drugs at the same time, new medicines as well as existing drugs used to treat Alzheimer's disease or anxiety and depression. Neurologist Dr. Zuvanka Pal will be overseeing the project.
There has been a lack of progress so far with discovering new therapies for motor neurone disease, and I think anything that we can do to improve the quality of life and the survival of people with motor neurone disease is a step forwards for this condition.
This is an illness for which there is currently no effective treatment, let alone a cure. This trial at least offers some hope in the face of an especially cruel and indiscriminate disease that robs families of a future they once took for granted.
Dominic Hughes. A new study suggests Neanderthals living 100,000 years ago were able to dive into the Mediterranean Sea to gather shells to use as tools. The findings are based on analysis of shell tools from central Italy, and they challenge the theory that diving skills were introduced into Western Europe at a much later date. Warren Bull reports.
The researchers from European and American universities examined 171 shell tools dated to 100,000 years ago. The clam shells were found in a coastal cave in central Italy. Under the microscope, the shells appeared shiny and unmarked, rather than opaque and worn, indicating that Neanderthal divers must have plucked live clams from the seabed, rather than merely collecting their shells from the beach. The study's authors say the finds add to evidence that Neanderthals could wade or dive into coastal waters to collect resources, long before modern man arrived in Western Europe with these skills.
Warren Bull. The Saudi security forces are reported to have arrested a number of people who are accused of trying to smuggle cheetahs into the country. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston has the story.
The Saudi media said the suspected smugglers had travelled on foot across rough terrain on the border with Yemen. The security personnel noticed movements in bags that the group was carrying on their backs. The bags were opened and the cheetahs discovered. The animals are trafficked from the Horn of Africa to the Gulf states, where they're sold as pets. Conservationists say many die en route and that the illegal trade is threatening to wipe out the cheetah populations in countries like Somalia and Ethiopia.
Alan Johnston. Now, let's remember the passing of an era in Chinese history.
In the fields of the struggle for production and scientific experiment, mankind makes constant progress and nature undergoes constant change. They never remain at the same level. This brilliant dialectical materialist idea of our great leader Chairman Mao's has proved to be an irrefutable truth and is being most convincingly borne out by practice.
An extract from a propaganda film from post-revolutionary China extolling the achievements of the country's agricultural sector. An extraordinary symbol of that period died this week. Liang Jun was the first woman tractor driver in the newly communist country. That in itself was interesting, but in 1962, an image of her driving a tractor was featured on China's 1 yuan banknote. Razia Iqbal spoke to Rana Mitter, professor of the history and politics of modern China at Oxford University.
Yang Jun became an iconic figure because she was essentially the first woman, or at least the first woman to get publicity, to become a tractor driver in Chairman Mao's China. She had trained just before the revolution that brought Mao to power, and that meant that she was one of the first wave of, you might say, female icons who took jobs that had traditionally been performed by men, and that gave her a great deal of symbolic importance in the early years of communist China.
And it was particularly important to the party to prioritise the mobilisation of women.
It was. One of the major social changes that is absolutely visible in the early years of Chairman Mao's China is the changing status of women. And in that sense, it was symbolic of a phrase that Mao himself used, that women held up half the sky. Now, let's be frank, not everything was exactly a feminist paradise in Mao's China, but gestures and also laws of this sort were important.
And she became a cultural symbol after her picture was printed on the banknote. Is that the kind of critical thing about her, that her image was used to make a point as well?
It was, but it actually became something of a process of making of an icon. So because she was essentially the first famous female tractor driver in China, a position of symbolic importance, she was placed on banknotes. But there were also movies made about her. There were also textbooks, which included stories about her rise to that status. And this was all linked to a set of what became essentially red heroes that the Chinese Communist Party was attempting to publicise the population.
And when we look at the fact that she was a tractor driver and the focus on agriculture, and I just wonder about that in the context of what was actually happening in agriculture in China in the 40s, 50s and 60s.
Yes, the picture that was put forward of Liang Jun and her tractor was obviously meant to be a kind of propaganda image of modernized, technologically enabled agriculture. The reality at times was horrifically different, most notably during the Great Leap Forward policy of 1958 to 62, which she certainly would have lived through. This was an attempt that was made by Mao and his government to accelerate agricultural and technological production in China. It went hideously wrong. They asked far too much, particularly from the peasantry of China. And as a result, a famine was caused in the Chinese countryside. That meant that not only was agriculture disrupted, but much more seriously, 20 million or more Chinese starved to death in the countryside. So there was a very, very dark side to this agricultural revolution, of which Liang Jun was the more sort of shining propaganda positive side.
Rana Mitta, Professor of the History and Politics of Modern China at Oxford University. And that's all from us now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm James Reynolds. Until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.